Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-7168, David T. Long et al., Appellant versus Howard University. Mr. Williams for the appellant, Mr. Prius for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, Harvey Williams for the appellant, David Long, and we have chosen to reserve 2 minutes for a rebuttal argument. In this case, David Long proved that Howard University violated the Rehabilitation Act when it refused to make a modification to the time to degree rules in its graduate physiology program. That verdict was entered by the jury in favor of Mr. Long, and it was thwarted by a faulty jury instruction that was both improper in that that defense had been waived consciously by the defendant during 4 years of litigation. And it was also erroneous because, as a matter of law, the statute of limitations for the civil rights claims could not have been applied to this case. First, with regard to the issue of abandonment,
arguing express waiver?
Yes, we are. Well, we are through their actions. They took a position that is quite clear that they were not choosing to apply the statute of limitations to the civil rights claims.
I understand your course of conduct argument, yes. But I thought it was an implicit waiver argument.
Well, they didn't send me a letter saying we're not going to assert it, but their actions indicated that they weren't taking that position. I think they're five key things that occurred in this case which distinguished the facts of this case significantly from the Dangerfield case, which is what the court relied upon. Here, first of all, in the discovery responses, they gave no factual basis for a limitations defense as to the civil rights claims. In the request for admissions...
Wait.
Yes?
I thought in their answer to the interrogatory they did assert their statute of limitations claim.
What they did was they had an answer which said a statute of limitations, just generically boilerplate.
They didn't limit it to any particular cause of action.
Not in their answer, but in the answer to the interrogatory.
Was
insufficient in the following respects. First, it was two sentences in that answer.
Well, but one of those sentences was pretty clear. It says, failed to timely file this lawsuit. After first receiving notice that the university would not readmit him without satisfying certain requirements. I mean, yeah, it's short, but it's pretty clear.
Actually, it's not clear, Your Honor, because the facts of the case were that Howard didn't place any restrictions on admitting him to the program. He was admitted without restrictions. The question came up, what would be required to restore his candidacy, which is a separate and distinct question. So the what was alleged in the interrogatory answer was not a fact at all in existence, so it was really a meaningless statement. And if you look at page 407 of the, 404 of the appendix, which is when they accepted him, it just said David Long is hereby notified that is hereby accepted into the graduate program in physiology. There were never any restrictions placed on that. This whole case involves, once he's in the program, what requirements will be required of him in order to meet the...
Sir, I thought the issue was whether the university had waived its statute of limitations defense. Isn't that the issue?
It is the issue.
Okay.
This is just the first prong.
And the question is whether you were misled during discovery, not thinking that they were not asserting the statute of limitations with respect to the disability claim, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. This is not the main thing we're focusing on.
Oh, it's not?
No.
Oh,
this is the first thing.
So it's the lead.
What's that?
Isn't it your lead argument?
Well, it is, but it's not the main. It's not the main factor which indicates that they waived it.
I thought you said it's you had 5 points.
I do.
And this is just your first one.
Yeah.
All right. What's your second one?
The second one is in the request. We sent requests for admissions, requesting that the university tell us or admit that they had made a decision to refusing to modify the 10-year rule. And in each one of those requests for admissions for years 1992 through 2000, the university denied refusing to make that accommodation. If they were going to take the position that we made a decision that we were not going to modify the 10-year rule. They had to admit that in their request for admissions. Instead, they took the opposite position for the years prior to him applying, saying that we never denied him modification of the 10-year rule. And that's also in those that's in our supplemental appendix, which was filed in August. Pages 6 through 8, we sent essentially 15 requests for admissions in subparts, asking them to admit that they refused to modify the 10-year rule for years 1992 through 2003, and they denied that for every one of those years. If they're going to take a position that the statute of limitations starts to run because we made a decision that we were not going to make a modification for this gentleman, they had to admit that, not deny it. So but that's the second discovery issue that led us to believe that. But more importantly, the more overt examples of their waiver came in response to our opposition to summary judgment, where we filed a motion for summary judgment on liability. And this was not an accidental waiver or an inadvertent omission. Howard filed their response, and the only thing they raised with regard to the liability as a defense was a liability on the contract claim.
So they took the risk, didn't they, that if the district court had granted your motion, then they'd be barred from raising the statute of limitations.
That's correct. And
but
for that reason.
Why is that tantamount to a waiver?
Well, because when a party files a motion for summary judgment on liability, it's incumbent upon the other party to advise the court as to all of its defenses. A party doesn't have the luxury.
I understand your argument. It has some attractiveness given what the rules are all about, but that seems not to be the position this court has taken.
If you're referring to the Dangerfield case, I think that is completely distinguishable because in Dangerfield, it was the defendant who moved for summary judgment mm-hmm. and decided not to assert all the claims that it might. Mm-hmm. That's a decision they can make without waiving the that defense. That's completely distinguishable from the United Mine Workers case, where the defendant failed to raise the statute of limitations in opposition to a motion for summary judgment on liability, and there the court held that it was waived. As a matter of fact, the language is quite clear in United Mine Workers, where they say the failure to raise an affirmative defense in opposition to a motion for summary judgment constitutes an abandonment of the defense. And they cite a number of cases. And this principle is also articulated in the Violin case, which I know is not out of this court, it's out of the D.C. Court of Appeals. But we cited that in our reply brief. The facts are remarkably similar to here, where George Washington asserted the defense in their answer. They abandoned it during the course of litigation because they didn't raise it in motions, and they were deemed to have waived it by the D.C. Court of Appeals. That was a 2008 case. The next factor indicating waiver was at the pretrial conference in this case on November 6th, where two things. We filed a joint pretrial statement. That's at our appendix, page 95. And on page 101, the defendant, we collaborated together to file this joint pretrial statement. The defendant says the only statute of limitations defense is only being raised to the contract claim and the tort claim. Okay? Then we get the jury instructions for the first pretrial conference, and they submit only a statute of limitations instruction on the contract claim, and nothing at all with regard to the civil rights claim. At this pretrial conference, we learn that counsel who's here today, Mr. Priebus, is coming into the case 4 weeks before trial, and I think it's pretty clear that he had a different theory of the case that he wanted to articulate at that point, but this case had been litigated for 4 years. With a position that was carefully staked out by previous counsel for Howard.
Now, in your reply brief, you argue, well, just let me find out, what is your fifth reason?
I lost count here.
You're on four, the pretrial conference.
Okay. This gets to my fifth. This is probably the last main reason. There's two things at the pretrial conference that come up, and I've cited this in our reply brief. The court asked, are you planning on filing a motion in limine? Asked the other side. Are you planning on filing a motion in limine as to the contract claim with regard to the statute of limitations? Doesn't say anything about the civil rights claim, because the court knows it's never been part of the case. Mr. Priebus, for the first thing he said in the case.
Well, the district court asked him one thing, and he said, yes, and we're going to go further.
I'm sorry? He wanted to know whether a motion...
Counsel said yes, and we're going to raise a statute of limitations as to other matters as well.
Well, yeah, and what he said was very telling in the quote I quoted in our brief. What counsel said was, quote, I believe there are some serious limitations issues that have not really been raised yet in this case.
Right.
That's the whole point. He said he knows it hasn't been raised. He knows that Howard's prior counsel took a different position than he would have taken.
So you argue in your reply brief that you were prejudiced.
We were.
And do you want to tell me specifically?
Well, sure. We were prejudiced because if we had been told, look, we have this this defense because Howard made a decision they weren't going to modify their time to degree rules prior to more than 3 years before this lawsuit was filed, and had given us dates and documents and witnesses, which is what our interrogatory requested, we would have done discovery specifically on who has authority to make a decision for Howard University with regard to a degree requirement in the physiology department. When was that decision made? When was it communicated to Mr. Long? We didn't do any of that discovery, and this is very important because...
Don't we know when it was communicated in the two letters in 95 and 98?
Those were not letters saying we're not going to modify our tenure rule. Those were letters in response to his request that they honor what he thought that he had an agreement that he thought he had with Howard when he left in 1991. And those letters were merely responsive to him when he said, his letters were, I want to be reinstated and defend my dissertation. Their response every time was, the letter from Laval Cothran, the chairman of the physiology department at that time, was the most telling. He said, neither I nor any other person can reinstate you. You need to apply, and your status will be evaluated by the physiology department. That did not happen until 1999. So prior to 1999, this segues into our other legal argument on the instruction. Prior to 1999, the Rehabilitation Act provisions were not implicated with regard to Mr. Long and Howard University. They were not implicated until he became an applicant or a student.
Do you think he has to be a formal applicant? I mean, he has to actually file a thing that says application?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You think it has to be an actual formal application to be covered by the Act?
If someone's requesting a change in a degree program, I do, and I think the language of the statute is actually quite clear. The regs under education and under the Rehab Act, specifically 45 CFR 84.44.
In his July 25, 1995 letter, he says he's making, quote, an official request.
He does.
To be reinstated. So, but your point is the Rehab Act doesn't apply to him at that point?
That's correct. He has no status.
That can't be right.
Why?
Suppose they had responded to this letter the next day, which says, in response to your official request to be reinstated, we are denying that because you're handicapped. No violation of the law?
I think if they made an overt statement that we're going to deny.
No. Your argument wasn't based on whether it was overt or not. You said at this point he's not an applicant and therefore not covered by the statute.
I'll tell you what, I think he would have a claim there that would not be considered unripe because Howard would be communicating to him that they're going to take a discriminatory action towards him. And I think under the futility doctrine, he might be able to actually come in and file the claim before having applied. But that would be...
Do you have any case that supports that theory?
Futility?
Yeah.
Sure.
Or do you have a case that even supports the notion that the Act doesn't apply until you file a formal... I mean, I hesitate to ask the question because it says, this is a, quote, official request to be reinstated as a graduate student and be allowed to defend his dissertation under the previously agreed statements, under the previous agreement. So,
right. His choice of the word official, I don't think, implicates the ADA or the Rehab Act.
So your theory is if the university had responded and said no because you were ill.
They didn't. Correct.
Then that wouldn't be a violation of the Act.
If the university responded and said, no, we're not going to do that.
Because you were sick. That wouldn't be a violation of the act.
If that's all they said, I don't even think it would even come close to being implicated. If they said because you were sick, he has to be disabled.
Well, disabled.
Obviously.
This illness can be a disability.
Again, I think if they made a definitive decision and said we're not going to do anything you want because you've been disabled, that would, I think, obviate the ripeness doctrine.
I don't understand that. If the statute doesn't apply until he's a formal applicant, then how can the way in which the university expresses its discriminatory action change that rule?
Because it doesn't change the rule. What it does is the whole point is he doesn't have standing to sue until he's applied and been injured. However, if they indicate to him that you don't need to apply, that's going to be a futile gesture because you've been disabled, we're not going to grant any of your requests anyhow. That's a different fact situation in this case. And I think if they sent him a letter and said we're going to discriminate against you because you've been disabled, I think at that point he would not have to go through the futile gesture of actually filling an application. I think there he would have sufficient standing to file an ADA claim. But that doesn't mean the statute would start running.
I don't understand that because, I assume any plaintiff's lawyer would properly argue that this July 25 letter we're talking about and the subsequent letter, the one where the dean asked him to sign the letter, remember? Whichever one that one was, April 98. Those two letters, true, they don't say we're discriminating against you, but they say we're refusing to admit you on the terms you want, and I assume your argument would be that that's a discriminatory act because it's refusing to accommodate his illness, which is a disability.
I have to disagree with you on what the letter said. They didn't say we're refusing to admit you. That what they said was you need to...
They're refusing to change the rules. You've got to finish your dissertation.
They didn't say they were refusing to change the rules. They said you need to apply and your status will be evaluated by the graduate training committee.
And it says
his doctoral candidate. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It says his doctoral candidate. I'm looking at the April letter. It says his doctoral candidacy had lapsed. Right? But that, you know, if it wasn't obsolete, they'd admit him on certain terms, and if it was, then he had to start over with a new project, and if you agree with this, please sign and return it. That looks like a pretty clear, or it looks like a jury could conclude that that was a pretty clear rejection of his official request for admission on the terms of his original understanding.
This is only relevant to the contract claim. Is our point. And I think that's something that the court should take a look at. After he applied and was admitted in 1999, the dean of the graduate school went over to the graduate training committee, which is the group that decides whether modifications will be made to degree requirements. He goes over to them and says, hey, we should make an accommodation for this person because he's been sick. And they said no. And he gave some of the same terms he gave in the 1998 letter. And they said, forget about it. And these people that made this decision, this is on page 407 of the appendix, none of these individuals on the graduate training committee had ever had any communication with Mr. Long prior to his application. They were the ones that decided. The representations made to him by Dean Taylor of the graduate school, they had no legal import whatsoever.
Did you make the argument about 84.44 to the district court? I didn't see that in your arguments in the district court.
We made the argument in we specifically pointed out the regulations in our motion for new trial. We objected
in the reply, I think, is where it first made an appearance.
That might be.
Even if it's in your motion for a new trial, isn't that too late. Under Rule 51?
No, I don't think so. Because actually, if that were all we did, yes. But that's not all we did. We actually objected.
But you didn't object on the ground that Judge Kavanaugh was asking you about.
Well, we...
Is that right?
We didn't cite the regulation at that point to the court. But there's two things about this. First of all,
did you alert the judge to the theory embraced by the regulation?
We did in the sense that we objected essentially three times, which we think alerted him. On November 30th, 2006, and we filed objections to their proposed jury instructions. We filed an opposition to their objections to our instructions, where they brought in a bunch of new instructions. We said that, first of all, we said the statute of limitations has been waived, and then we said that the questions articulated in the instruction are legal issues to be decided by the court. Then subsequently, we filed another.
And that doesn't really.
Doesn't say.
Well, that's just, we had three. Okay.
Then that's one.
That's one. The second one, we objected, we filed objections right before trial, and we said the instruction does not inform the jury that Howard had to have reached a conclusive decision on the matter before Long could be responsible for knowing that he's been injured. While it doesn't specifically say the regulation, what that means is that Howard cannot make a conclusive decision on a claim for modifying a degree program until the person has applied and or is a member of the degree program. So we think that that's sufficiently brought the issue forward, and we also discussed it along the same terms in our discussions with the courts, and that's at Appendix 597.
I don't see anywhere where you told the district court judge that the claim could not possibly have accrued before 1999 because the plaintiff was not a student or applicant.
We didn't use those exact words, but we think we sufficiently triggered that notion by informing the court that it was wrong as a matter of law to not tell the jury that it has to be a final decision of the university. And the second thing we raised in our brief is that even if we said nothing whatsoever, this is a plain error situation where the court has instructed the jury that they can consider acts occurring before a person is an applicant or a student to trigger the obligations of a program under the ADA and the Rehab Act. It's clearly contrary to the Code of Federal Regulations that we cited.
Counsel?
Yes.
You're way over time.
I know.
Why don't we hear from counsel for Appellee, and then we'll give you a minute.
Thank you.
Right.
May it please the court, Daniel Priebus for Appellee Howard University. Mr. Williams began by emphasizing that the jury reached a favorable verdict on one issue in his favor, but what he obviously neglected to mention is that the jury reached a favorable verdict for Howard University on the statute of limitations. So what he's basically trying to do in this case through a variety of means is to upset a jury verdict, which not only the jury ruled that way, but the trial judge similarly addressed the issues and came out the same way. And he's trying to do that where on each issue that he raises, there is a very limited standard of review by this court, either plain error, abuse of discretion, and so forth. Needless to say, our view is that none of the appellant's arguments have any merit. Let me start with the waiver issue. I think that English language is pretty clear in some respects, and that the statute of limitations defense was raised generally as to all claims in the answer. And I would just note the answer read plaintiff's claims.
Let me ask you, counsel, you don't deny, though, do you, that there could be a waiver as a result of how the litigation is conducted? Defense is adequately raised under 8C.
Yes, there are certain circumstances in which a defense can be waived. One of them is if it's not raised before the final pretrial conference and not included in the among the issues that the judge is going to try.
That's
not the case here.
Cut off, looking at the other circuits, that so long as you raised it before the final pretrial order.
Yes, that's what the law seems to be. There are some other possible circumstances. If it's not mentioned at all in discovery, that could be a waiver under certain circumstances.
You don't want to go there, do you? I mean,
pardon me?
You don't want to go there.
Well, I'm just saying there's an abuse of discretion standard here, and the trial court looks at the issue, looks at the all the circumstances, and decides whether. It believes that there's been a waiver.
Course of conduct, and you don't mention it during discovery. That's precisely what the appellant's arguing.
Well, it was mentioned during discovery. It was
not as to the statutory claims.
It was mentioned in the interrogatory answers. It was mentioned in the interrogatory answers, which
where specifically?
Well, it's very prescient. The interrogatories stated that Mr. Long failed to timely file his lawsuit after first receiving notice that the university would not readmit him to the graduate program without satisfying certain requirements.
All right.
The focus there was on the first action, which is exactly the theory of the case when this came to trial. Was there a mention of all the particular theories, that all the particular counts that applied to all of them? There are some arguments that Mr. Williams made that were never made before the trial court. He referred to the request for admissions. He never referenced them before the trial court. They were never admitted into evidence. And his argument's wrong anyway, because for several reasons. First of all, a denial to a request for admissions is of no evidentiary significance whatsoever. Secondly, what Howard did in its denial was to deny that it had refused to make an accommodation. Howard made plenty of accommodations to Mr. Long. For example, Howard accommodated him by providing that when he returned, he would not have to replicate experiments that he had not replicated, because working in a lab with fumes and so forth would be difficult for him. Howard accommodated him in April 98 when it said that he could come back and he could count courses that are more than 10 years old, provided that he passed an examination. So there are plenty of accommodations. Howard never denied that it declined to grant the modification that Mr. Long wanted, which was to come back and just defend his dissertation without any other conditions. There was a reference to, I think by Judge Rogers, to the fact that when Howard filed its summary judgment opposition, it did not raise a particular defense. And as Your Honor stated, Howard took the risk. Howard took the risk that it would lose on summary judgment without having an opportunity to have raised that defense. And that's within the judgment of counsel, whether to raise all the arguments or not. There's no holding that that where a defense is asserted in the answer, that that a claim is waived. I would just point out, in terms of whether there was any prejudice here, Howard raised the limitations defense, by my count, six times before the final pretrial conference.
As to the statutory claims?
Pardon me?
As to the statutory claims?
Yes, in the answer and in the interrogatory answers on November 6th at a pretrial conference, on November 9th by motion, in limine motion, November 30th in proposed jury instructions, and on December 1st, 2006 in the final pretrial conference.
Right, I think conference. The argument is, though, that discovery had closed by that time.
Exactly, and there was discovery had not closed when the interrogatory answers.
No, but by the November 6th, November 9th.
Yes, but the notice in the answer and as well as the interrogatory answers gave all the notice that was required by law. That's the Dangerfield holding.
But if you could just focus with me for a moment, the discovery had closed, and at that point, what is your response to his claim of prejudice?
At the point discovery had closed, Mr. Williams, first of all, he never identified or argued any prejudice to the trial court. Okay, that's number one. So he's making an argument now that he didn't make below. Number two, Mr. Williams was not prejudiced because he had the answer and he had the interrogatory answers, and he took every deposition that could have been taken under the sun. He deposed all of the people. He asked all the questions. He reviewed all these documents. He asked questions about every decision. And we put into the record just to illustrate that, the joint pretrial report, which lists the depositions. I think there were over 20 depositions in this case, easily.
But your answer is that even had you expressly said before discovery closed, after asserting the defense in your answer, in the interrogatories and at any other point, you had said expressly, we are raising the statute of limitations as to the statutory claims, that discovery would have been no different? Is that your response?
Absolutely, and it's not only my response, it's what the trial court found the trial court had supervised this case closely through discovery. You only have to look at the docket sheet to see the long course of discovery, the motion practice. There were motions.
But did the district court make that finding expressly?
Yes, I believe the court did. And if you hang on 1 second, I'll refer to it. It is in the it's in the court's findings.
Well, maybe you could let the clerk know.
Okay.
Where it
is the
court's
the trial court
a joint appendix site.
Yeah, the trial court stated my recollection is that there's really no prejudice or something to that
right.
to that effect.
What about these?
I'm not sure about that.
I didn't find it. But.
Okay, well I'll provide the citation.
I don't think that's there.
Deputy clerk. Let me just address briefly the question of when the statute of limitations accrued. Once again, Mr. Long never challenged the sufficiency of the evidence to support a statute of limitations instruction prior to the jury verdict. Therefore, he cannot raise that issue here at this time. But let me say that this whole argument that he makes, I think, is that you have to be a student in order for, or an applicant in order for the university to act. I think it's really preempted by the April 30, 1998 letter, which doesn't have a word in it about Mr. Long having to reapply. To apply for readmission in order to be admitted. That's at the appendix 391. There's nothing whatsoever in there. And in fact, the dean, who is, after all, the final decision maker for the graduate school, tells Mr. Long there, you can't just come back and defend your dissertation, but you can come back under certain accommodations. And all you have to do is sign this letter, and you're back, and we'll proceed. There's nothing in there about having to apply for readmission. So I think that sort of, as a factual matter, cuts off that argument. But if you're going to look at it further, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act is what Mr. Long.
You need to be clear about that, because I thought. The 95 letter had clearly told him he was invited to apply for readmission. And then after he got the Taylor letter in 98, he wrote to the president of the university, who basically told him to submit an application.
Right. But
and then that's what he did in October.
Right. April 98, this is the dean of the graduate school. And if you look at the graduate school's rules, the dean has the final say on these matters. The president has no official standing or role in these decisions. As of April 30, 98, he's told, all you got to do is sign this letter and you're back in. And the fact that he goes and then asks the president later on, that's a request for reconsideration. That doesn't re-trigger the running of the statute of limitations. But let me just also point out that Mr. Long did not sue under one of these regulations under the Rehabilitation Act. In fact, it's uncertain whether he would have standing to sue under those regulations. If you look at Alexander versus Sandoval, which is a Title VI case, he sued under Section 504, and Section 504 doesn't require you to be an applicant or a student or have any particular standing of that type. If you're disabled and you're not given a reasonable accommodation, you have a cause of action. And that's even noted in one of the regulations, which the trial court noted, which is, I think, 44.4, which says if you're excluded from a federally funded program on account of your disability, that's it. I'd be happy to entertain any other questions the panel has.
No, thank you very much, counsel.
I'll provide that cite to the...
Thank you.
Perhaps I could stand up at the end and just mention it to the court.
You can give it to the clerk. Counsel for appellant, anything further?
Your Honor, if the court allows, I did reserve 2 minutes. I know we went way over.
Well, we're way over. We'll give you a minute. Okay. Anything that needs to be said?
Just a couple of things to look at. With this issue of restrictions placed on him being accepted, if you look on page 404 of the appendix, it's the evaluation data sheet when he was accepted.
404?
404, correct. And this follows actually the memo where they accepted him. If you look down there, it says admission approved. It's a check mark. And it says provisional acceptance. There's nothing checked. There was no restriction or requirement or anything else placed on him in being accepted. Every student has to follow the rules and regulations. So the fact that he has to follow the rules and regulations is not pertinent. This case is about the failure to make a modification to those rules and regulations. With regard to this waiver abandonment issue, the fact that Mr. Priebus may have tried this case differently is not important. He came in 4 weeks before trial with a brand new theory, and I think it was pretty clearly staked out by prior counsel that they weren't going to assert the claim.
All right. Go ahead. Anything new you want to point out to the court? You made that argument already.
I did. Okay. One other thing that I hadn't pointed out yet. It is in our brief. The issue came up about the educational contract, which we sued under breach of contract claim. At trial, in discussing whether the pamphlets and the university's policy on discrimination applied to Mr. Long, Mr. Priebus said they didn't apply to Mr. Long in 1999 because he was a stranger to Howard in 1999, which is our point precisely. Until he became a student or applicant, those rules would not apply.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll take the case under advisement.